Felton, I thank you very much. I'm Tommy Lover, a grateful, recovering alcoholic. A few days ago, very recently, I heard a discussion about, you know, we alcoholics are nitpickers. A discussion about whether we ought to say I am a recovering or I am a recovered alcoholic. And I thought I might just avoid this right quick and start saying to people, I am a grateful, recovered, recovering alcoholic. And I can go even further. Because of a just and loving God and the fellowship of you in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am a covered alcoholic. This has been such a marvelous weekend. It just... I'm not sure why I keep on, after all these years, letting myself get talked into taking this spot. There's not anything much left to tell you about AA. My father told a story for a great many years, and I can think of that right now. I'm full of the weekend, and I know you are. He said back over in one of the country churches up in North Georgia, there was a protracted meeting going on, and it really got stirred up one night, and everybody got the Holy Spirit. And at the close of the service, a preacher called on an old brother sitting down in front and said, Brother Joe, would you lead us in prayer? Brother Joe said, Preacher, you'll have to get somebody else. I can't do a damn thing but cry. Now, many of you know that I am a retired Methodist preacher. For Sunday morning, I have had the use of my word damn. I'm entitled to the use of the word hell one time. I preached a great many years about this place, and for a lot of years I stood in a lot of pulpits and I wanted to look at a congregation and say to them, what in the hell is wrong with you? I certainly want to express my wife Gay's and my appreciation to all of those who are responsible for our being here to share with you. To Roland and Charlie and Lillian for so many little extra things and their concern and their care. And to you for caring about us. I got near resentment though sitting here a few minutes ago. You notice who Charlie blamed for you not being able to smoke? He didn't take responsibility for it. He slithered out of that just like a snake. The speaker said do it. I am grateful to you. I'll make you a better deal. Go ahead and smoke, just don't exhale. I'm just so grateful, though, for the care and the love and the concern and the friendliness that's been shown us. I've been telling my wife, Gay, for 40-something years that Georgia people were the best people in the world. I'm from Virginia. I was born in Newnan, raised in Columbus, and this is why I've been telling about Georgia people. Many years ago, I heard a speaker get up and say a word, or utter a statement that sort of teed me off for a little bit. And the more I've thought about it, the more real and accurate I realized through the years he was. He got up and he said to an AA assemblage, welcome to the convention of the abnormals. And I've never really appreciated being called abnormal, but I guess in the eyes of a great many, we are. I've been retired a little over 2 years now with a disability, with emphysema. I have about 40% of my breathing capacity. And incidentally, I want you to know something, that I turn into the hospital once a month. And every month that I go, my doctor says to me, are you still going and speaking and preaching a little bit? And I say, yes, sir. He says, you're not supposed to be able to do that. And I guess I'm not supposed to be able to do it. But God and I made an agreement that as long as he could use me anyway, I'd show up if he'd take care of the rest. And I'm trusting him to do that today. But since my retirement, I've had time to really just sit around, and for want of other things to do at times, I've tried to look and see what normal people were like. I've been astonished. Let me tell you about normal people just a minute. Normal people believe commercials. It seems to me that they think it's normal. This gal's driving an 18-wheel truck and trailer. She stops in the middle of an interstate highway and gets out and feeds a dog, and everybody stops to watch. They seem to think this very normal. And every normal woman that rinses the gray out of her hair dances into every restaurant she goes in singing about it. Ms. Olson and a coffee. That's the way normal people drink. You notice not long ago she showed up in a commercial with a leg in a cast? Some alcoholic found out she's selling 13-ounce cans of coffee. That's where she got that. And I've lifted the lid off the water closet in my bathroom many times real quick trying to catch that guy in that little boat. If I ever catch him, I'm going to take an old toothbrush and sink him. But normal people do this. And I've got to admit, I'm getting a little more normal. I watch soap operas. One of my daughters-in-law said to me once, "Pop, you watching soap operas?" I said, "Hell, I'm talking back to them." The reason I know I'm getting more normal, week before last was a hard week for us. Peter Taylor died, Joe Riley died. You see, I know exactly who's been watching soap operas. A lot of us getting normal. But enough of this. A great many years I've had the privilege of speaking in many places in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had the privilege of listening and sharing. And I have just rejoiced at these programs with the speakers in each of the hours. Beautiful little Alateen, that lovely A woman, Al-Anon. And I used to say for a long time to people when I'd get up, "Well, I'm Tom Lovern, and I only have one story, and it hasn't changed. And the only way I know to change it is to go out and get drunk, and my story will change." Now, there are a few of you who I've known over the years, I must say to you sadly for a moment, but only for a moment, I come to you this morning, my story's changed. I have the task of telling you briefly and quickly what it was like twice, what happened twice, and what it's like now. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous not because I had any desire to be here. We were living in Chattanooga. I was traveling as an engineer for one of the major insurance firms. I was drinking constantly. Our life was unmanageable. I say ours because mine, being as unmanageable as it was, had caused every life around me to become a bit unmanageable. But on one occasion, I was up in Nashville. I called home about middle of the week and reminded Gay that I remembered the weekend would mark our anniversary. And that if she and our then one little boy would get ready, I would hurry home on Friday. We would go to Lookout Mountain or somewhere to celebrate the anniversary. And Gay was thrilled because, for one thing, I had called you about Wednesday not drinking. There was never any question over the phone whether I was drinking or not. Gay could smell liquor 300 miles over the telephone. And I guess she was happy that, in spite of so many shortcomings, at least I had remembered a very special occasion in our lives. I hung up. I remember so well that day, and I sat down in the hotel room, and I thought, Tommy, you've been a bit unduly concerned about this problem. And I hadn't been to AA anywhere else. I'd talked to a few people privately about it up at this point. I said, you've been unduly concerned. Really, it's not all that bad. I think you're prone to be a little hard on yourself. Nobody but a good man would remember his anniversary and call to express appreciation for this. Surely you're entitled to one drink. You know, in 3 minutes, I could con myself into anything. I had the drinks, and I got home Friday of the following week. I had my first long blackout. I left Nashville. I don't know all the places I went. We later found out I'd been to Mobile, Birmingham, all over. Wound up back in Nashville. And I came to on a Friday morning and sick, and you know the feeling. And after a bit finding out where I was with the realization of what I'd done, I became frightened. I am firmly convinced that the arrogance in most alcoholics is nothing but a sham to cover his fright. And I got ready as quickly as I could, and as shaky as I was, and started home to Chattanooga, and all the way I began trying to think of another lie to tell. I found out I'd run out of lies. And you know that old arrogance got to working again, and just as I drove into the city limits, I thought of the thing I'd do. It's my house they live in. It's my money they spend. I hurt nobody but me. I just don't have to take a lot of gruff about this. If it's too bad, I'll just get another suitcase and leave. And I went into our home, and I excuse me, I sort of leaned in, you know, like you lean into a strong wind. Some of you smile, you know what I'm talking about. You know it's coming and it's got to get through, and you just sort of lean against it as best you can. But it didn't happen, and I like fell on my face. Gay was sitting there calmly, I don't know, sewing, crocheting something. She looked at me a minute or two and she said, Tommy, your boss said the moment I saw you, you would have called him in New York before you made another move. The office was in our house at the time. It was shortly after World War II, and just space wasn't available anywhere. And I went on back towards the room in which we had placed the office, and I tried to think of a lie to tell my boss. And I was thinking, too, my God, Gay has ruined me. The boss wants, she's been telling him. He's getting ready to fire me. And I was dialing the phone all the time, and finally we got him, an operator did, and he came on the phone, and I said, Lee, this is Tommy. Tommy, where in the world have you been? Gay and I have been frantic. We've called all over your territory. We've checked hospitals, jail, police. Nobody knew where you were. What happened? And I had a stroke of genius. I said, Lee, you know, in all the years I worked for you, I never lied to you. I've been drunk for a week. And I left him speechless. I remember feeling like I'd found some secret. New power. Hit people with the truth. They don't ever know what to do with it. He recovered enough to say, Tommy, I believe you've been working too hard. Well, that's what normal people would say. You know, I said, appreciate your honesty. If you won't tell anybody about this down there, I'm sure not going to say anything up here about it. We'll just take this week out of your vacation. Can you imagine? Home free. I started to say goodbye. Lee said, just a minute. Have you ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous? Yes, I heard a little something about it. I didn't tell him how. I didn't want him to know that Gay papered our house with the reprint articles of Jack Alexander. She had found this thing, and she sensed immediately that in it was the answer to prayers and problems. And she'd gotten a hold of these pamphlets and put them all over the place. I'd seen them there. I hadn't touched one. And finally, I guess in self-defense, I did read it, and she waited. And when I finished, she said to me, "What do you think of that?" I said, "You know, Gay, that's very interesting. Who do we know that needs this?" I admitted I'd heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "Well, in our conversations, we found that there's a group in Chattanooga. And it occurs to me that there's going to be a meeting tonight. When you hang up, Gay's going to call a nice man and lady, and they're going to come and get you and take you. And if you want to go to work for me Monday morning, you better go with them." And I hung up, lost all that power. I turned around, and there was Gay with that quizzical look on her face that said, "Big boy, if you want me here to send you to work Monday morning, you better go with him." And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I went for the next number of months. I perverted everything I was told. I didn't go because I wanted to be there. I resented every minute I was there. I resented the people that were there. They were weaklings and failures. They were admitted failures. I was on the way up. I hadn't failed. You see, I didn't know that I was on the way out. I do remember with great joy learning something that just, well, I didn't have to have an excuse for drinking anymore. Because you told me I was sick. And I could go home and stop Gay right in her tracks. Come in 2 or 3 days late off the road. And she said, "Tommy," I said, "Gay, just a minute. It seems to me you're never going to understand anything they tell you down at AA. "Well, Gay wasn't the AA. I was. I said, "Gay, don't you remember? I can't help this, honey. I'm sick. And remember what they said, don't get me upset. That's the worst thing you can do." Some years later, as an aside, Gay came in one day. She'd been to the doctor for a regular checkup. She came in all smiles, and the boys and I were there in the living room, and we looked at her, and we said, "Wait, what's up?" She said, "I've been waiting for years to say something to you fellas. The doctor just told me to come home and tell you all that I've reached that place in my life that you are not to upset me. That's the worst thing you can do." Well, AA meant little. About all it had to do with our lives, that it exercised a bare modicum of control. You see, I loved Gay and my son, and I had a deep appreciation for my employment. I loved Gay and the boy as much as an alcoholic is capable of loving. Never do they find the capability to express it. The job, the employment, gave me a sense of belonging and some sense of achievement. And I used what you said and what you were just enough to fool my employer. Some months later, I was promoted to supervising engineer of the Gulf Coast area. We were transferred to New Orleans. We moved into New Orleans on Mardi Gras Eve. And on July 4th, Mardi Gras, you know, is in February, at the beginning of Lent. On July 4th, the thing I loved the most in my life was gone, Gay and my son. I was not employed. And I was sitting that morning on a park bench in the midst of Little Jackson Square in the Vieux Carré. Two guys came in and sat down on either side. They came because that morning they'd met over to AA Club on Charter Street for coffee. One had said to the other, "Have you seen old Tom?" "Nope." Why don't we take a minute or two and go see where he is? He's in the quarters. You see, back up in Virginia, there was a woman who loved me and who had sensed in her own faith a glimmer of hope in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She didn't cease to pray, she increased her prayers. She left me not because she no longer loved me. She left me for self-preservation. We were expecting another child. It turned out to be twins. She could no longer stay there in safety. Up in Chattanooga, there was a little short guy that I loved so much, even the memory's dead now. Bob Ivins had seen in me the sure hope that one day I'd make this program. Little old Bob Ivins prayed and telephoned New Orleans regular and said, go find him, go find him, go find him. And on this day, I became a believer in third-party calls. And they sat down one on either side and said to me, Tommy, have you had enough? You have no trouble answering this when you're sitting there with everything gone. I slept the night before in Seaman's Rest. The engineer that the insurance company couldn't run without. The day they fired me, I went across the hall to call on another company. I knew how badly they needed me. He wouldn't even see me. No, I said, I'd had enough. You don't have to stay this way. You see, I knew that. In no time at all, I was back in Virginia. Our family was restored. I had employment through the friendship and graces of AA in my field of engineering, more lucrative than the job I lost, probably with even a greater future. And I was joined with my friends at Alcoholics Anonymous, with one exception. When I went in and they sat down with me, I said, now let me tell you about myself, and I told them. And I don't want to drink. I want to be sober. I want what you guys have got. I've had enough. But there is a little problem. You fellas talk a lot about God. And I'm not ready for this. I'm not sure I'm ever going to buy this. I didn't come out of any such background as that. I know today what I was saying even then was crying out in the dark, hey, I think I've forfeited my right to this God. And I'm scared and I don't want to be told about it. I know those new friends in AA were doing the best they could, I suppose, at the moment. But I was told the biggest lie I've ever been told in my life. Oh, they said, Tom, that's all right. You know, this is a program that you just take out what you want. Anything bothers you, throw it out the window. God, I wish you'd been with me the next 3 years crawling around outside that window looking for everything I threw out. I went home that very night and took my 12 steps. I thought, well, now I can do it this way. Step one, no problem. Step two, there's God. Tell you something, if you haven't read them this morning, he starts at step two and he don't get out of them. I had a one-step program. I admitted I was an alcoholic and told people what a great thing this was on every bar stool around me. You know, I got drunk. I never knew anybody to stay sober very long, just admitting. I went back to AA, I didn't have anywhere else to go, and I said, well, this didn't work. I want you to know that I had 5 sets of sponsors. Every time I got drunk, I got new sponsors. I went back and got a new set. The set I got this time was therapist. You know, some of you way back in those days, how we threw around the words group therapy. This is before it was popular. I thought, well, this group said to me, Tom, just get in with us. It's the therapy of the group. I was therapeutized as few have been. I might have made it if my therapist hadn't gotten drunk and I got drunk with them. They didn't have any more program than I did. Oh, and I went through the whole rail. Well, enough. There came a day, 3 years and 5 drunks later, When I woke up one morning and was sick of me, thank God. I stayed away from her a few weeks because I was so sick of me, I didn't want to see me there. I couldn't stand the scrutiny of this thing. But I kept thinking. In those approximately 3 years, while I did nothing, God was slowly and surely at work. You see, I'm the one that went in and said, help me. And I forgot to tell him I wanted to end this deal. And in thinking, I began to realize there were some people around AA that were a little different. They had something in common. It was the look in their eyes, or the serenity they'd found, or the peace of their countenance. Pure joy of living and the certainty of every day. It might have been the man or woman doing 12-step work. It might have been the man or woman standing behind the podium trying to speak words of encouragement. It might have been the quiet little guy that comes in ahead of everybody and sets out the ashtrays and stays after we're gone and cleans them up. Every club's got one. If you want an agreeable surprise some night, find out how many people are sitting in there because of that quiet little fella. Then they had something else in common to my amazement. They all had a belief in a high power. And they were making it. They were making it. Among those that I saw, there was one almost twice my age. I've never quite understood what there could have been in common between us other than we were alcoholics that drew me to it. Maybe I saw the father figure, I don't know. But I called Jack White one day and asked him if I could see him, and if I use names here, I'm not breaking anonymity. These people no longer live with us. I went over to see Jack, and I said, Jack, as you well know, I've made a mess out of everything. And I'm tired of this, and I'm sick of me. Jack, will you help me? Will you help me? He said, Tommy, I've been watching you. And I've really hoped someday you'd come and say this. Sure, I'll help you. And then he got to be the sponsor of sponsors. I'm going to help you, but you're going to shut up. I don't want to hear a thing out of you for weeks because you don't know nothing. You're going to join AA. I've been around AA 3 years. You've never been in AA. You've just been hanging around in the way. We're going to do it my way. And I love you, but the morning you decide to do it your way, get another sponsor. He was right. You see, I've been exposed to sponsors. I love my sponsors. I still got sponsors. Mine rode in here yesterday from Virginia to see what I was doing. Came up and told me this morning, said, from all I understand, it's been a very good conference. Don't you go up there and louse it up this morning. And we began my tutoring under old Jack White. He said, we're going to learn how to pray, and we're going to talk about God. I said, Jack, I don't know how to pray. Weren't you brought up in a church home? Yes. What do you mean you don't know how to pray? I said, oh, Jack, I've mouthed words. I never have been conscious of anything in prayer. We said, I understand. Let me tell you about prayer. He said, not too many years ago, I was a patient in Keele Institute over in Greensboro, and let me tell you, Jack White had become so bad in his alcoholism that they had closed his office and his business in Richmond. He had moved into Keele and was running his business out of his room in Keele Institute. He stayed sober in the room. If they let him go downtown, they had to go get him. He said, one evening a nurse came in that I'd been seeing for years around there, and she said to me, Mr. White, did you ever think about praying? Said, I told her, no, I don't know how to pray. She said, you must know some prayer. Well, he said, there was a little prayer I used to pray as a child, you know, now lay me down to sleep. He said, a nurse told me that might be enough, Mr. White, and walked out of the room. Now, Tom, let me tell you about prayer. He said, within an hour or less, I'm a man 55 years on my knees at a hospital bed, praying, now lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. And then he didn't even know the prayer right. He said, I prayed if I should wake before I die. I pray the Lord my soul to take. Now, I've thought about this a lot of times, and I've come to the belief that's the way the prayer ought to be written. You and I know of many a night when the only prayer we had, should we wake before we die. And he said, I got off my old bony knees and got in bed, and I'm had a drink since. That was enough. And I said, Jack, I think I can pray that. And I began in my own halting way to pray whatever I could pray. Some days it was, God, you know me better than I do. Do something. That's enough if you pray it from the heart. Jack said, we're going to find God. And I said, Jack, I don't know how to find God. He said, no, you've been looking in your educated mind for him. Julia and I were talking to a good doctor, friend, some few years back. A real problem. We spent a couple hours with him. He was agreeing with everything we'd say, and then he'd put it in words we couldn't understand. We got up to leave. I said, well, Doc, I sure wish you the best. Now, you know, we'll do anything we can for you. And Julian didn't say this. He said, you know, I think you're too damn smart to get this. You may have a lot of trouble getting this program. You're too intelligent. Or at least you think you are. Well, bless his heart, that good doctor friend is still fighting it a little bit. But it's going to work because he's praying now. And my sponsor began to teach me when, how to find God. Let me tell you just a couple of places. Somebody asked me yesterday if I'd tell it. I began to find God in the commonplace, everyday happenings of life instead of behind a maze of theology. Incidentally, not long after my conference with Jack, I made my decision to enter the ministry of the church. And I served my church as minister and clergyman for 27 years. I don't know why I went, except that I found out in a little while with Jack's tutoring that I was a weak individual and I better be where God could find me every day. And that's why I went. I was sitting before an ordination committee once, just before my final ordination to orders in the ministry, and old bishop wandered in. When a bishop comes in, you invite him to join whatever you're doing. They said, Bishop, would you like to question the candidates? There were four of us, and he looked right at me. You see, there were three kids and me. I'm a little later in life with this, and I'm getting in the back door. He said, Brother Lovin, tell me about your call to the ministry. I said, Bishop, you know, to tell you the truth, I never was called. I could almost see the wheels going around that old man's head. I knew what he thinking. I know we short of ministers, but we ain't this short. Before he could say anything, I said, Bishop, God beat me into here. I didn't like it coming. I'm not sure I like it yet, but I'm here. And God willing, I'm going to stay. Early in my ministry, I was serving a church. Down east in Virginia, in my congregation was a man who became a fine friend. He was a state forester. He learned in the fall of that first year that I was an avid hunter. And on the opening day of duck season, he came to share with me his own duck blind way over in the Chickahominy swamps. He called for me way before dawn. We got in his pickup truck and drove and drove. Got back into the swamps. We got out and walked for quite a distance. Then we got into a small boat with a small motor and started down through those cuts and guts of that swamp. Finally, we came to an open body of water, but all the way down in this pitch darkness, I'd see a shadow that was a little blacker than the ones around me. And by the time we got to the open body of water, to be honest with you, I was frightened of the place we were in. You can imagine all sorts of things. The only thing that seemed certain to me was that there was no hesitancy in my friend. He knew exactly where we were going. We finally got across this open body of water, and I was conscious that we were alongside a shadowy thing that was a duck blind, and we got the boat stored away underneath and got into the blind, and we whispered to each other a little while. It was that kind of morning. And then for some strange reason, we no longer even whispered. We stood in the total quiet silence of that day. As we stood there, I think my friend knew that I was having some sort of spiritual experience, and he no longer spoke or bothered me. As we stood in the still, absolute quiet of that place, I was conscious of the chirping, timid as it was, of the first bird of the morning. And suddenly over here there was a timid answer. And then this one was a little more bold, and this one. And little by little you could hear a whole chorus. We heard a deer wallow somewhere behind us. I know it took longer, but it seemed to me that in the twinkling of an eye, God's sun and light came up over that old swamp, and those old cypress trees became things of beauty instead of the shadows of fright. And I stood thinking, this is what the psalmist meant. Once I was blind, but now I see. And God came alive. We never fired a gun, though ducks flew over us a dozen times. A little while, my friend said quietly, "Tom, you want to go?" I found God. I'll never stand any closer to God than I did that minute. I've just been looking in the wrong places. I was in a dark room early in the morning up in Ohio one day. I'd gone there to accompany my oldest son away to school. It had not been a happy time, and yet we were joyous. But when your firstborn leaves the nest, you cry. And we did. As I was getting ready to return home, we were living in Clearwater, Florida, and I had gotten up long before daylight, and we stood together in the room, this great big fellow. And I suddenly had this almost obsessive urge to go over to him, put my arms around him, and kiss his cheek. You see, this boy remembered his father as the alcoholic. And the years that had passed, he'd grown to respect me. We had a kind of association. It was not bad, but it wasn't what I wanted. We weren't yet father and son again. As I stood there, I suppose in my own embarrassment, hesitant because I guess he's bigger than me, suddenly it was as though the gates opened and he came across the room in a leap. He put his arms around me and kissed my cheek. Told me how much he loved me and how proud he was. You can't stand any closer to God than that. In heaven's gate you won't be any closer. Time and again, my old sponsor just pointed me the way. And I began to find God over and over. And it goes on today. It goes on. It goes on. I entered the ministry of the church. Gay and I were blessed with four sons. And if I talk as a man obsessed with the love of his sons, I don't even ask your forgiveness. I am. They've been my life. We had a happy home. We felt some sense of service because God had granted us this. And there was beauty about us and love and friends all over the world because of the fellowship of AA. And I used to tell the story and bring it to here and say to you, this is how it is now. Today I have to say to you, this is how it was. A few months before June of 2 years ago, I was told finally by two physicians, one a pulmonary specialist, one my family physician, three really, another one a friend, that, Tom, you just as well accept the fact you're through working. You can't go on this way. You're drawing on reserves that don't exist. I knew they were right. My dear wife, who is my lend-lease from heaven, would look at me with love in her face and almost anguish to try to hold me up. I didn't know I was doing it then, and certainly deserve no credit. My oldest son told me later, he said, Dad, I used to watch you preach on Sunday morning and go home and almost die for the lack of breath for the next 2 hours. And they were all urging me, now relax and take your disability retirement and come and be at ease. You know, I didn't know that I was beginning to build resentments. And they were there. And I went for months with them not knowing they were there. Let me say to you, and if you don't hear anything else I say, remember this. Here's a man who can assure you that resentment is one luxury we alcoholics cannot afford. I resented my doctors. I resented my church. I resented Gay and the boys. They were making me quit work. They weren't making me quit work. But outwardly, we went on with the plans, and we went to the Board of Pensions. We did everything we were supposed to do. We left our parsonage in June, turned over our church to other hands, moved into a little cottage over on the Shenandoah River at the foot of the Massanutten Mountains. 6 weeks later, I called my pension board and said I didn't get my check. They said, you don't have a pension. My whole world fell. I didn't know I'd built my faith in institutions. I discovered a bottom lower than the one that brought me to AA. Now listen, you old-timers, hear me. Hear me. I found a bottom lower than the one that brought me to AA, and I had never been told about it in 27 years. I know today because I didn't know anybody to tell me. I suddenly didn't care. Friend said to me, Tom, did you forget you were an alcoholic? No, I didn't forget I was an alcoholic. I didn't care. Did you forget AA and all the thousands of friends? No, I didn't forget you. I didn't care. Did you forget Gay and the boys? Oh, God, no. But I didn't care. As my old sponsor said to me, bless his heart, you did what any screwed up alcoholic would do normally. You went and got a bottle. I tried to get drunk for 2 days. I drank for 30 hours. I never got physically drunk. But emotionally and mentally, I got horribly drunk. Gay was with her mother, who was ill. It was as though everything went by design. Towards the afternoon late of that second day of this, I guess inside some things began to happen that I wasn't aware of at the moment. I'd been running. I didn't stay at home. I knew they'd find me. I slipped into home and got my pistol out of the drawer and went up on Massanutten Mountain. I'm not a man of courage, I'm a coward. But I sat there a few minutes and I thought now, and I reached over and turned on the CB, I'll call my friend, the deputy sheriff, and tell him to come up here, it's an emergency. And he'll come. And I will have done this thing and have it over with when he gets here. It won't be at home, it won't mess up anything, Gay won't have to worry with this, they'll take care of it. And I sat there and couldn't do it. The first consciousness real of that moment that I remember today, of course, you know, you have to wait and look back. I remember finding myself sitting there hollering. Oh, God, what am I doing? My God, what am I doing? That was my prayer. That's all I prayed. I put that gun on the seat, cranked that car up, and came home. I drove into my yard, and two DA friends from Pennsylvania drove in right behind me. In minutes, Julian was in my house. In a few more minutes, I was surrounded by A's, by telephone and voice from all over everywhere. Nobody in A said, "Why did you do it?" "Oh, Tom," they said, "come here." That long night, I came out of that newfound bottom. It'll only take me a minute to tell you. I began to think about a great many things. The problems had not changed. I'm afraid I was still not caring all I needed to care. But I began to remember a few things. I remembered how God had dealt with us in our needs so many times. I remember the day I went up to the college when I decided to enter the ministry and sat down with the president of that college and said to him, "You know, I left this college 17 years ago. I'm an engineer, but I don't have anything in the background to make me a minister. And I want to come back to school and monitor classes and do whatever I need to do." He said, "I'd heard you were coming. You got any money?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "I don't understand. God don't ever call anything but poor boys to the ministry." I said, "Dr. Mullen, not only do I not have any money, there's about $7,000 worth of debts and bad checks floating around down south. And I got to find some way to cover all this." "But we will." He said, "Well, I don't know how you're going to make it." I said, "Be assured, if I don't make it here, I'm going to make it somewhere." He smiled and he said, "Tommy, I had a visitor the other day, a couple of men. They came and told me about your intentions. And they said I was to tell you when you came that because they loved you and believed in you, that as long as you were here studying for the ministry, you and your family would have everything you needed." "Who were they, Dr. Mullen?" "Oh, I can't tell you that." A bell rung in my mind, anonymous. The second funeral I ever conducted in the ministry. Dr. Ted Adams at First Baptist Church in Richmond and I shared the funeral of a dear friend, Turner Bethel. Dr. Adams stood up and said, "This young preacher with me is the pride and joy of the man we bury. He went to the school to help him become a minister." When Jack White died, his wife said, "Tom and Jack took such joy in thinking that he could help you become a minister." The truth. Do you know we never had to go to the office and ask for a thing? See, God dealt with us. I thought of this and I cared. And I thought of a day that I stood in the pine trees behind Roanoke Memorial Hospital on the side of Mill Mountain over in Roanoke, Virginia, and Gay laying on a bed from surgery. She had been hemorrhaging for almost 2 days after a very extensive operation in the sinus cavities for the removal of polyps, and it had not gone well. And I'd come into her room on this afternoon, and the doctor came rushing out as I came in, and a nurse, and I turned and followed them down the hall, and the nurse said to me, "Mr. Lovin, I've just found a blood clot behind Ms. Lovin's eyes, and they're going to have to go in and get it out, and they can't give her any anesthetic." I went back and looked at Gay, and she cried, and I patted her hand. I said, "I'll be back in a minute." And I went out on the hillside behind that hospital. Each floor let you out a little high up that mountain. Soft, gentle rain, and I stood in those trees, and I prayed. I guess like this, I said, "God, Gay and I have asked you for a lot of things, for a lot of people, and you never fail us. We don't ask you much for ourselves. You've been too good. But God, I'm here to tell you, you've got to do something now. This woman's had all she can stand. She can't take any more. You got to do something. I went back in, and we held each other for a moment or two, and I prayed. They came and put her on a stretcher and wheeled her away. I went out in the hall and walked up and down, smoked a couple of cigarettes. Finally found a chair to sit down for the long wait. When suddenly the elevator doors opened and they came rolling out. They'd been gone about 20 minutes. She was propped up on one elbow. The padding and packing was out of her nostrils. She smiled and said, "I'm going home tomorrow." We went in the room, and a few minutes, her doctor came in, and he walked over and looked at her and looked at me. He picked up a book, walked around, laid it down, picked up something else, walked around, laid it down, looked at us. He said, "Reverend Lovern, I'm a good doctor." I said, "I know you are. You wouldn't be tending to Ms. Lovern. I don't make that kind of mistake." "What mistake, doctor?" "Wasn't any blood clots. A tiny, minute speck of dried blood." "Doctor, you didn't make a mistake. Someday we'll talk." I remembered what God had done. Me, with the audacity to stand and tell God, "You've got to do something." And he did it. And I remembered, and I cared. Oh, I cared. One other thing, among so many I could share with you, I remember driving my sponsor around the city of Richmond in the last day he lived. He'd been in the hospital over in Richmond dying of throat cancer. He'd been trying to stay alive till the Virginia State Conference, and he made it. We hung a banner in his room and brought down his name tag, and people went to visit him. Then he said, "If I can stay alive 3 more weeks to go to Blackstone, it'd be all right with God and me if I just died over there." He wouldn't lay down because he knew when he did, he's going to die. He sat in a chair for the last several days of his life. And on this morning, Dr. Jones called me and said, "Tommy, come on up. Jack wants you to do something for him." And I went up, and he said, "Jack wants to ride around the city a little bit." I said, "Dr. Jones, can we?" He said, "Tommy, nothing can hurt Jack now." We called the young boy at his office, and they brought his car to the hospital. We put Jack in a robe, virtually lifted this terribly bony little figure out and set him in the robe with his hat in the car with his robe and hat on. "Where do you want to go, Jack?" We drove out on the edge of town to the city dump. And there were a bunch of tar paper shacks. He said, "Go and get the man in that house." We went, and there was a dear old white-haired black man who came out, and I said, "Mr. Jack White." "Yes, sir." "Wants to see you." This man went out, and Jack leaned as best he could out the window and supported his arm with one hand and took his hand. He said, "I want to thank you for all the beauty you brought in my life. You kept my yard beautiful, my flowers grew. I come home every day and see your handiwork and God's about me. I want you to know, Sam, how much I appreciate you. I love you, and I want to tell you goodbye." And we left. We went to his office and parked in the alley, and he went up and got all the employees down. He said, "I want you all to know that I've already attended to this. This business belongs to you. Every bit of it is yours. You've worked and made me prosperous so I could AA. And now I want you to have it. And I want to love you and tell you all goodbye." Several places. We went back to a hospital room, and I started to help him in the chair, and he said, "No, I want to get in the bed." I knew what he meant. He lay down, and I stood there before leaving and said, "Jack, can I do anything for you?" He said, "No, Tommy. But I want to tell you something. I love you. And I want to thank you for letting me sponsor you." Oh, God. Thanking me for letting him save my life. I remembered, and I cared. And I want you to know I care today. Oh, how I care. Few people have the privilege of coming through this blessed fellowship twice. I'm having that privilege. Oh, I have silver chip. I have one with a little stone in it. But I got a little purple poker chip in my pocket that says 2 years, and I'm very proud of it. I've learned one more thing that please allow me to share with you. The older I get, I guess the more I'm an emotional slob, is what it is. I found myself ashamed of tears. And I had to deal with myself in this. And I've come to the realization that to weep is one of God's blessings. I weep with sorrow and hurt when one of you hurt. I weep with anguish almost when one of our number falls. But I've learned too to weep with gratitude, more often silent than openly, for the blessings as they come. I came into this place this week. Roland met me in the driveway and put his arms around me. We are really new friends, and I wept with gratitude for my new friend. In minutes, I found Clarence and Martha. To see Clarence looking so much better and so good is, God, it's worth my trip. And I just weep with gratitude. I found Rhodes, Mildred, and Claude, his dear wife, oh, so many of you. And it's like being home wherever I go. I talk with Margaret and Virgil. And see, when I had my trouble, I had to cancel a lot of engagements. Margaret was the first person I called. And she made it a little easier for me. I've learned to weep with gratitude for the blessings God reveals day by day. A few weeks ago, we were in my youngest son's house down in Richmond. And Gay and I were sitting enjoying a new granddaughter. Little Marie was in Gay's lap, and like baby, she had reached over with her little hand and had caught Gay's finger. And as I watched him, I became conscious of the absolute perfection of that infant's hand. The fingers were so perfectly formed. Everything was in proportion. It was so beautiful. Almost transparent, the flesh and skin. It was not a blemish. And as I looked, I realized that Gay's hand that that little one held. Gay has some knuckles that are big from a bit of rheumatism. Time has caused blemishes on her hands like so many. The veins show. And as I looked at that beautiful little new hand holding her hand, I thought to myself as I wept with gratitude, the greatest thing I can wish for that little baby girl is that one day her hands are as beautiful as my wife gazed. Her hands got that way looking after me. I weep with gratitude today because you have loved us, because you care about us, because with God's grace and you his instrument, we're enjoying it again. That's how it is now. Dr. Robert Schuller has one of the greatest philosophies I've ever heard. He said every life must come to a mountain, and inevitably we all will. When the time comes, you dare not stop. Try to go over that mountain. If you can't go over it, go around it. Maybe you can't go around it, start digging through it. And if you can't dig through it, you've already started digging. Just stay down and make a gold mine out of it. I want to say to you that we've come to our mountain. God knows we can't get over the mountain of alcoholism or around it or through it. But we've been brought to a gold mine called AA, and we're digging. Let's dig and dig. We got a gold mine. God bless you.